Were you court appointed?
Yes.
You were. I'm sorry. Thank you. You have the thanks of the court for ably representing your client. All right. Case number 3, 0319 16, the Illinois Department of Human Services et al. Versus U.S. Department of Education et al. Good morning. Ms. Weiler. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Catherine Bosky Weiler, and I represent the appellants, the Illinois Department of Human Services. As a preliminary matter, as Your Honors are no doubt aware, on Friday afternoon, my opposing counsel informed me of the potential that this matter is now moot. The underlying issue that is not to be resolved by this Court involves a contract dispute, and I was informed by my opposing counsel Friday afternoon that that contract may be expired. However, unfortunately, without the contract, we cannot make a determination of whether or not this is a new contract or a renegotiation or some sort of extension of the original underlying contract. With the permission of this Court, we would be happy to brief the mootness issue, but we would like to proceed with our original argument.
Of course. Will 10 days do it for you,
yes,
do you
Your
think?
Honor. Yes, that would be adequate.
It would be adequate?
Yes.
All right. If it isn't, under these circumstances, you can ask
for an extension.
For more.
Great.
And for the government as well?
Or yes,
afterwards?
For 10 days. Yeah.
And Your Honor, just as a point of clarification, shall we be filing the initial mootness argument, or would you prefer to hear from the federal government on that issue first? Only because we do not actually have a copy of the contract as yet.
No.
We'll begin with it. Very good, Your Honor. Your Honor, this appeal arises out of the determination of an arbitration panel that was appointed pursuant to the Randolph-Shepard Act. The Randolph-Shepard Act is a federal statute that grants statutory priority to blind entrepreneurs who seek to operate vending facilities on federal property. It is similar, though not identical, to a federal statute called the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act, or JWAD, which provides for a procurement list that individuals, blind or severely handicapped individuals, may try and obtain contracts to provide goods or services through this procurement list.
Let me go straight to the principal point of your argument, because if we were to disagree with you that the concept of lashes is the kind of remedy that's being talked about in 1070-2, then it seems very difficult for you to get around the point that in either of the kinds of arbitration authorized by 1070-1, Part B or Part A, all it says is you convene a panel to arbitrate the dispute, and whether something's been exhausted, whether it's been filed in a timely manner, all manner of procedural points, whether you got your brief in on time, all manner of things could cause an arbitral panel to decide that it's not appropriate to go forward with a suit. And so I don't see, in some sense, how your definition of lashes means it's the same thing as saying specific performance of a contract, or it's the same thing as saying pay damages, or it's the same thing as saying reform a contract, all of these affirmative things that D-2 takes away from the arbitral panel in terms of its remedial authority.
Your Honor, that is because the provision, which is it's 107D-5, Panel B, the panel
B
that involves...
B-1 subpart B is the part that you're talking
yes,
about,
that's
where
correct.
It's the state licensing agency, but it doesn't say anything about remedies.
That's correct.
All it says is convene a panel to arbitrate the dispute, and I'm suggesting to you that there are all sorts of reasons why such a panel might not reach the merits of a dispute. If it's established a briefing schedule and said you have to have your brief in by March 1st and your brief wasn't in by March 1st, the panel might decide that you weren't prosecuting. It might dismiss the action. If it thought in the situation where there's some exhaustion requirement, which I understand exists in some of these statutes, it might decide the prerequisites to bringing a suit haven't been satisfied. And by the same token, even if there's no formal statute of limitations, it might decide that you just sat on your rights too long. So I don't see why those don't all fall in the same package, why they aren't all, if you will, procedural reasons why the arbitration panel might say, we are simply not going to adjudicate this up or down. And I don't see anything in 107D-1 subpart B that says arbitral panels are stripped of the authority to manage arbitrations before them.
That fundamental issue, as Your Honor described, was discussed at length in both the Nash case and in the Maryland Department of Education case. Those courts, those were the 11th Circuit and the 4th Circuit, interpreted that provision of the statute to allow only for a yes or no determination.
In the sense of remedy, though, the context of those cases is so different. Of course, once an arbitration panel has found a violation, can it do anything else? Can it order any of these other types of remedies? The answer is no, because Congress has made the decision that the ball goes back into the court of the federal agency at that point. But those cases aren't talking about what I'm just calling the management of a lawsuit. They aren't saying that arbitration panels have no power to order discovery. They aren't saying that they can't discipline obstreperous litigants. They aren't saying all manner of things that this timeliness of instituting the action issue now before us sounds much more like than whether you can order specific performance from a federal agency.
Your Honor, the determination to dismiss a case, to not allow the presentation of a case because of Lashes, does function as a determination.
Well, and doesn't it the same thing? Suppose you filed your brief 6 months too late, and the arbitration panel in the meantime had said, I'm sorry, they're just not prosecuting. We're dismissing this arbitration because the state has not been diligent. You think they have no power to do that? You can set all of your own time limits. You can decide what you're going to comply with in the way of discovery or not, and they're absolutely powerless to dismiss?
In that circumstance, Your Honor, the arbitration panel could theoretically create a briefing schedule or some sort of guideline.
And it will not be conclusive on your case and what happened here.
Are you saying that the arbitration panel could never dismiss for Lachey's, even if IDHS had delayed 10 years in asking for arbitration, 20 years, 30 years?
No, Your Honor, because in that situation, presumably the contract would have expired at that point.
Why? Maybe it's a contract for life.
And if it has not expired, then there would still be a dispute as to whether or not there was an ongoing violation of the Randolph-Shepard Act. And the Act does presume that would be a possibility. The Act does not demand, as does JWAT or most of these procurement statutes, that the dispute would arise only in the procurement phase.
You're saying the panel's got to adopt or follow a state statutory limitation, is that right?
Only, Your Honor, if this court were to look for a specific statute of limitations, a specific guideline that would be more analogous to consider whether or not Lashes was appropriately applied here.
Is there is there any evidence that the General Assembly of Illinois was thinking about federal contract procurement practices when it passed the default statute of limitations?
No, Your Honor, although there certainly is an indication that Congress was considering those procurement statutes when it...
5 years is pretty unreasonable for a contracting situation, isn't it? You're going to keep the contract open for 5 years while this statute runs?
Well, in that instance, Your Honor, that would move directly toward this issue of prejudice and the way the Randolph-Shepard Act is set up, it allows for the federal government, the federal agency involved in this case, the Navy, to determine the least prejudicial manner in which to resolve that sort
of
issue.
But it's shocking to think that the state of Illinois thinks that delay in awarding a contract, leaving it in limbo for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, is costless to the federal government. Delay is phenomenally costly.
I must say I don't understand your argument that a victory for you will not unduly prejudice the Navy. I mean, if the Navy is required to give the contract to a blind vendor, I don't see how it can continue with its contract with Goodwill. The Navy may be able to convince the blind vendor to go operate with a Goodwill, but that would be entirely within the blind vendor's discretion. I absolutely can't get that argument.
It could be a provision in the contract that the federal government would require be signed between the blind vendor and the federal government. The blind vendor the state licensing agency who would be able to bid on this contract is not guaranteed the award of that contract. They only wish for the opportunity to bid on the contract. So in that situation, or as we have here, if the federal government is unable to determine the least prejudicial way to resolve this dispute, that could be a provision of any sort of contract that would be entered into, that the blind vendor involved would have to subcontract with Goodwill Industries.
Okay, but let's talk about this contract. The Navy claims that upsetting its contract with Goodwill would cause it to incur additional costs to break the contract, to re-award the contract, to retrain, to re-recruit employees. It'll be damaged by a loss of morale and efficiency, by decreased quality of food service. Does the state think that all of this is untrue?
Not untrue, Your Honor, but all of those problems could be resolved between the party, between the state and the federal government, through the course of working toward a new contract, reaching a new contract.
And yet, over what time period that you were deciding whether to ask for arbitration or not, you could have easily sent a letter to the Navy knowing that you were still weighing your options. I think you're in a very difficult position vis-a-vis the equities here.
Yes, Your Honor, and communication was made with the Navy expressly concerning this issue that the state wished to pursue its statutory priority.
It was a year and a half of dead silence on the part of the state. The state didn't even bother to object when there was a Federal Register publication of the Navy's decision to put it on the procurement list.
Well, the state did object in a December letter. That was the final letter that the state sent to the Navy.
But not at the relevant time. The state sits around and waits and talks and, you know, for all I know, they could still be talking. It's a very unattractive position to be in.
I see I'm in
and
my
recruits reverse. Are getting hungrier and hungrier while all this is going on.
They are being fed at present, Your Honor.
They're being fed while this process goes on.
Just
the bureaucrats fight with each other.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Rabinovitz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Let me begin by addressing directly the threshold issue of mootness, which we raised with the Court on Friday.
Are you going to give a copy of this contract, or have you given them what they need?
We have not provided the new contract.
No, but the old one
that
expired so they can examine the...
The old contract, Your Honor, is in the record at pages 620 all the way through page 845.
Oh, that's right. It's the wrong thing. Yeah.
It's a 220-page contract, which is all but indecipherable unless you're a procurement person within the Navy. You could look at it, and unless you knew what you were looking for, I don't think you could figure out that the contract had expired September of 2003. I certainly didn't, nor did the state.
So who knew? Who is this person that deciphers the undecipherable?
These are procurement people within the Navy, and the issue here and the reason why we were not provided with these facts before Friday is at some point it just happens that the people with the facts that are not lawyers don't recognize the legal significance of the facts, and it's only once the lawyers are provided with the facts that
Who's going to help us?
By way of the facts are now clear, Your Honor. The initial contract, the 1998 contract, which is what's challenged in this lawsuit, had a one-year base term and then 4 one-year options, each of which was exercised, and the contract as a whole, then fully performed, expired in September of 2003.
What if the state thinks it's legally relevant? I don't know what then replaced it. I assume the recruits at Great Lakes are still eating, so something is happening. What if they think it's legally relevant if the new arrangement is, in fact, a carbon copy of the old one and an agreement to extend by another, 3 one-year option periods? Just for example, I have no idea, but wouldn't they have some need to see in order to present whatever argument they wish to make to us? Obviously, you can make whatever point you want to, what it got replaced with.
I can certainly provide the facts. The reason I'm hesitant to give assurances that I can provide the new contract is because this issue is just so new. I haven't even had a chance to ask the Navy whether there are privilege issues in turning over the contract. But certainly, I can provide an affidavit which will provide any relevant facts. And to the extent that we can provide the contract, we certainly would.
Are 10 days enough for each of you?
I think we could do it within that time, if that's what the court chooses.
Well, no. We're going to choose what will do it for you.
If we had 20 days,
This has been going on for a long time. What's another 20 days?
Well, and I don't want to hold it up more than need be. If we had 20 days, we could then provide both an affidavit and a better legal analysis than we've been able to provide so far on
20 days each, or 20. 10 and 10, or are you going to work together? What are you going to do here?
What I would propose is if we had 20 days, we could then file our position with the court. The state could then have whatever time it needed, 10 or 20 days, to respond.
Okay.
And I don't think at that point we would need a reply unless the court wanted to hear further.
20.
Now, let me just explain the terms of the new contract just so that the court has it. There was a bridge contract signed that lasted from October of 2003 through December of 2003. The current contract was effective January 1st of this year. It is in some respects similar to the old contract. It is in others quite different. The duties and responsibilities of Goodwill Industries under the current contract are far expanded, nearly 200%
more. But is all this form over substance?
Well, Your Honor, if this is a new contract, then it would require a new determination from the arbitration panel as to the issue of any latches issues and to the merits. The arbitration panel's decision here was keyed directly to the facts at hand. In other words, that the state delayed in challenging the contract for a full 2 years after it was effective and for 30 months after it was first alerted to the problem. So whether the arbitration panel would, if it considered the question again, still find latches, based on the addition of the contract to the Javits-Wagner O'Day procurement list, is something that I can't answer and something that the court can't review without a decision from the arbitration panel in the first instance.
So I take it if the state were now to say, okay, now we're talking about a contract entered into January 1st, 2004, which apparently nobody had any idea was going on because of all this activity on Friday, they could get a new arbitration panel. Under the statute.
Now, to be clear, I believe the Navy would still make a latches argument. Before the arbitration panel, the Navy actually made two separate latches arguments, one which the arbitration panel considered and passed on, one which it didn't. The first one was the one we're familiar with, that the state simply waited too long to challenge the actual contract. The second was that the state waited too long to challenge the addition of this contract, of the contract in theory, to the Javits-Wagner O'Day procurement list.
Right, that's what I was referring to earlier when you had the Federal Register
So the Navy did make that argument before in the arbitration panel and probably would make it again if the state brought a challenge again. So, however, the arbitration panel didn't pass on it, so the court has nothing to review by way of that Latches argument.
Right. That's sort of a different action, though. That's an administrative action of putting it on the list as opposed to a contractual.
Correct, Your Honor. That's what I'm saying.
The mootness issue, you're going to get into the evading review exception?
I don't think
so. That have any application here?
I think it's something for the court to consider, surely, but it seems to me that the length here is long enough that this would not evade review. In the two cases that we cited of this court, James Lutterbach Construction and Tobin for Governor, in both of those cases, the court considered the evading review standard and found that a year and a half, amounts of time like that are plenty.
Why didn't the Navy delay awarding the contract until it settled its dispute with IDHS?
Precisely, Your Honor, because there was no dispute. I mean, the state surely was on record as having a different interpretation of the Randolph-Shepard
right.
Act, but had two avenues to exercise its legal rights and didn't. The first is what we know, the arbitration under the Randolph-Shepard Act. The second is the reconsideration process provided by the Javits-Wagner-O'Day regulations, which gives any interested party 60 days after the addition to the procurement list to request reconsideration. So the state had two avenues to seek legal relief as opposed to simply making their position known and didn't exercise it.
So is your position the Navy just didn't know there was still an ongoing dispute with the state until they came up with their much later Randolph-Shepard demand?
Well, I mean, not to be overly technical, Your Honor, but they knew there was a disagreement and that the state had a different position, interpretation of the statute. However, they did not know that there would be a legal dispute. There was no indication that the state would exercise its legal rights. And indeed, that didn't come until 30 months after the Navy first told the state of its interpretation of the Randolph-Shepard Act, and it didn't come until 24 months after the contract went into effect, the last year and a half of which, as Your Honor's already said, was in dead silence between the state and the Navy.
Did the Department of Education issue regulations under both of these statutes?
No. The Department of Education is responsible only for the Randolph-Shepard Act, Your Honor. The Javits-Wagner-O'Day regulations, I believe, are promulgated by the Committee for Procurement under the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act.
That's the
risk. Must create a certain amount of confusion, doesn't it, if you have two?
These are significant issues which have come up in other cases, we haven't cited a lot of the merits cases because this doesn't deal with the merits, but there are appellate decisions out there. This is an issue that will surely come up again.
Well, at the risk of seeming terribly naive, since the Navy would be responsible for remedying any violation of the Act, couldn't it come up with a solution that re-awarded the contract to the blind vendor, but did so in a way that would cause, minimal, if any, disruption and damage?
It's really sort of a question that's up in the air. In other words, we don't know what the Navy would have to do in order to come into compliance if indeed it wasn't in compliance, and I don't think that that's a clear issue, Your Honor. But if the Navy were held to be out of compliance, the state has provided no reason to think that the Navy could do anything other than simply award the contract to the blind vendor. And at that point, it's not clear that the blind vendor would certainly be under no legal obligation to subcontract to Goodwill. And in fact,
so you can't put a clause in a contract saying we're awarding you this contract on the condition that you subcontract with somebody from the procurement list, for instance?
Perhaps it could, Your Honor. That would still create significant problems at this juncture because we're so late in the game. The Navy would still have to breach the current contract with Goodwill Services. And I should, as an aside, I'll now speak based only on the facts as they were when the arbitration panel issued its decision and ignore the facts on the ground that we know now, because if this court does believe this is a live controversy, the only fact that would be relevant would be the arbitration panel's decision. Mm-hmm. But perhaps it could put that in. It would still have to breach the contract with Goodwill, and it would still lose the control over the general contractor in that you're creating more hierarchy. This is not a simple contract to administer. The Naval Training Center at Great Lakes is where all initial recruits come in for the Navy. It is an enormous program. And before the current contract, before they latched on with Goodwill, They had tried unsuccessfully with numerous other contractors to get somebody that was satisfactory. Changing that at this point would create a significant risk of disruption to the food service program, which would have a significant impact on the Navy's ability to feed its recruits. I mean, we can say it as a joking matter, certainly, but it's also a very real matter that they need this program to work, and it wasn't working before Goodwill, and inserting somebody else, a different manager, would create a real risk to the Navy at this point.
Mr. Rabinovitz, once upon a time, I sat in a district court for 8 years. If I were sitting in that district court today, I would say to the two of you, can't you talk this over? Okay. Save your time. Oh, you.
Let me address quickly the statutory argument. We've made you aware in the brief, the text of the Randolph-Shepard Act itself places no limitations on the power of arbitration panels to consider the application of latches. Both in 20 U.S.C. Section 107 D-2 paren A and in Section 107 D-2 paren B, the Randolph-Shepard Act directs that arbitration panels consider the dispute, which is best interpreted to include everything, every part of the dispute. This interpretation of the text is also supported by the background against which Congress was legislating in 1974 when it added the arbitration provisions to the Randolph-Shepard Act. Now, today we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Halsam versus Dean Witter that arbitrators have the power to consider latches unless there is an express contract by the parties to the contrary. More importantly, though, this was true in 1972. The Supreme Court issued a similar decision called International Union of Operating Engineers versus Flair Builders, where it made clear that absent an express agreement to the contrary, arbitrators have the power to consider latches. So 2 years later, when Congress added these provisions into the Randolph-Shepard Act, it would have been aware of the background against which it was legislating. In other words, the typical powers of an arbitrator. It is highly unlikely that Congress would have chosen to alter these familiar presumptions of arbitral power without mentioning it in the text of the statute and without a peep in the legislative history. And indeed, the only court of appeals to consider this issue, the Sixth Circuit, in Fillinger versus Cleveland Society for the Blind, has found that the Randolph-Shepard Act does allow arbitration panels to consider the issue of latches. Now let me address the state's counter-argument just quickly. It misreads the provision that deals with the remedies that arbitration panels can administer in two ways. First of all, the one that you mentioned already, Judge Wood, but second of all, the paragraph explicitly applies only to relief awarded as against a federal agency. The paragraph discusses that it applies by its terms only to when a federal agency has been found to be out of compliance with the Randolph-Shepard Act. But in this case, the remedy was issued against the state, not against the federal agency. It was dismissed on the basis of latches. Accordingly, by the statute's own terms, it is inapplicable to this circumstance. Quickly to whether the arbitration panel's decision was rational. Once we get past the statutory interpretation, which is the linchpin of the state's argument, it is clear that the arbitration panel's decision was rational. A delay of 30 months, absolutely sitting on your rights, when what's at stake is an important contract to the Navy and the jobs of the more than 200 blind or severely disabled people that currently work at the Naval Training Center at Great Lakes, when those are at stake, it is simply irresponsible and unacceptable as a matter of law to sit on your rights and let the Navy invest money in the contract that is so important to their basic recruits. Unless there's any further questions, thank you.
It may be a long time before these recruits get a square meal, I guess.
We'll see, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rabinovitz. Ms. Weiler.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points on appeal. First, Judge Rubner, as you noted, were you sitting in the district court, you would be encouraging the parties to simply work this out. The parties did do precisely that. The Navy was well aware that the Department of Human Services felt that this should have been, this contract should have been awarded through the Randolph-Shepard Act priority. They had informed the Navy of that. In that communication, they suggested that the department wished to avoid going to arbitration on this issue. But the Navy was unwilling to negotiate those issues, and as a result, we have reached this unfortunate position that we are still in dispute over this. It is also worthy of note that the ease or difficulty of how this contract is administered, how this contract was administered, and how this contract would be altered if it needed to be awarded pursuant to the Randolph-Shepard priority, those issues are not relevant to what the panel determined. The panel was not there to decide, oh, this will be difficult for the Navy to do, so we're not going to make them do it. The panel was there to decide whether or not the Navy's decision to award the contract pursuant to JWAD rather than the Randolph-Shepard Act violated the Randolph-Shepard Act. So it is not
And how do you respond to Mr. Rabinowitz's argument about his statutory language argument about 107D2, where he focuses on the language, if the panel appointed pursuant to paragraph 2 finds that the acts are in violation of this chapter, then the head of the agency does something. Why did Congress put that phrase in instead of a phrase that said, a phrase that was, let's say, more evenly balanced or are in not violation of this chapter?
That the language just, it's
language says if we find that the state wins, then this is what happens. But why doesn't it say anything about if the state loses?
The statute seems, because the statute is only anticipating a yes or no.
They will always win.
No, not that the state will always win, but that the panel will reach a determination, yes or no, that the federal government was in violation of the statute or not. And if not, then if the federal government is not in violation of the statute.
You would agree that this sentence only addresses one half of the equation. In terms of its remedial instructions, it only addresses the half of the equation if the decision is against the federal agency. It says nothing about remedies if the state has.
That's correct, Your Honor, because there would be no need for remedies.
Well, there might be attorney's fees, there might be costs, there might be a number of things that could come up.
That's true.
The state has breached something else.
Well, whether or not the state had breached the statute could not be at issue in this type of
situation. In any event, there are all sorts of ancillary things. And as I said, I mean, getting back to my other point, I'm a little shocked at the idea that in the state's view, there is no procedural flaw that the state could commit that could lead to the dismissal of an arbitration action. That's a very sweeping position for the state to take.
Your Honor, the perhaps the most instructive view for that is from Robert Humphreys, one of the arbitrators who, in fact, authored the 1974 amendment.
No, but I don't care what Mr. Humphreys thought. I mean, the statute is the statute, and the legislative history is the legislative history. If Mr. Humphreys is trying to tell me that courts can't, or arbitral panels can't enforce deadlines, and arbitral panels can't regulate the conduct of lawyers in front of them, and so on, I think he's perhaps exceeding whatever deference he's entitled to as a drafter of a statute.
Yes, Your Honor. It simply is not the same to say that a panel cannot create some sort of procedures within the panel and to say that the panel cannot
What about conditions precedent to suit? Powerless, I suppose, to dismiss if the state fails to comply with the condition precedent?
Well, the panel could not consider the arbitration if the state did not comply with the condition
precedent. And that's what it's doing here. It's saying we're not going to arbitrate this because the state failed to comply with the condition precedent, namely timely action.
Well, Your Honor, there is no description of what a timely action would be for the panel to reach that determination.
Okay.
If this court has no further questions.
No. Thank you both very much, and the case will be taken under advisement.